In our study of Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, we come this evening to the fourth chapter of this letter. And I want to take as the theme of the chapter words spoken by the apostle in verse 16, where he says to the Corinthians, "I urge you to imitate me." I urge you to imitate me. In the first four chapters of this letter, Paul is dealing with divisions in the church at Corinth. Sad and distressing divisions, which were causing him great concern. In the first two chapters, he deals with divisions over the gospel. They were not agreed as to the gospel they should be pursuing. And then in chapters 3 and 4, he deals with a division over leaders in the church. And these were the two issues connected to each other which were dividing the church. They were dividing over leaders, different leaders, following different groups. And they were also dividing over the nature of the gospel they would believe and preach. And the apostle has called them back to the message of Christ crucified, the only gospel, the true gospel, the gospel in which God's power is seen. And he has tried in chapter 3 to give them a better perspective on leadership, and we looked at that last Lord's Day evening. But it wasn't just an abstract debate or controversy about leadership. There was a strong personal element in all of this. It wasn't just the case that the Corinthians were divided over various leaders. Some say, "I follow Paul." Others, "I follow Apollos." Others, "I follow Peter." No, the problem was more complicated than that. Many of the Corinthians were very critical of Paul himself. And they were not so much for other leaders as that they were anti-Paul. They were rejecting Paul's authority. They disliked his ministry. And that is something that is going to cause Paul enormous sadness and heartbreak later on in his ministry. I believe one of the greatest griefs of his life was the way this church in Corinth treated the man who had been used by God to found it. And when he writes 2 Corinthians, he's a man who's very, very deeply distressed and burdened indeed. Here in this church, people had risen up who were casting off the authority of their old pastor and leader and turning against him. And that's what he's dealing with in this chapter. The way the Corinthians are behaving towards him. Now we may ask, what relevance has that to us as we sit and listen to that chapter this evening? Well, perhaps some are tempted to be critical. Perhaps we are too critical, some of us. We may be too critical of Christian leaders, of ministers and elders whom God has placed over us in the Lord. Perhaps we're too critical of other Christians, our brothers and sisters, and we need to learn from Paul here. So he speaks to the critical. And I think we'll see also, perhaps more relevantly, more pointedly, he speaks to the comfortable. Perhaps many of us have become far too comfortable in our Christian lifestyle. And we need to hear these pointed, searching words of the apostle. And we may find that Paul's teaching is more disturbing than is comfortable for us. We may find that we are more like the Corinthians than we would like to think. Now, in addressing his critics in Corinth, the apostle makes three main points, and I want to try to outline these points for you very briefly and simply. And you'll understand that in the course of one message, I can't possibly deal with everything in the chapter, so it will be a highlighting and an outline of the apostle's thought. I want you to try to get the drift of his thought in this chapter, so that when you go back and read the chapter and reread it for yourselves, you'll be able to follow what the apostle's saying, and perhaps to expand your thinking on it. He makes 3 points to his critics. The first point in verses 1 to 5. They have no right to judge him. They have no right to judge him. Note how he begins in verse 1. Men ought to regard us as servants of Christ and as those entrusted with the secret things of God, or a more accurate translation, a more literal translation, as stewards of the mysteries of God. Here is the true identity of the Christian leader. Christian leaders are servants of Christ, not servants of men and women. Christ is their master, and it is to him that they are responsible. When you think of us, he says, think of us as servants of Christ and as stewards of the secret things of God. Now, in the ancient world, the position of a steward was a very honourable and dignified and responsible one. The steward was the manager of a great estate or a great house. He was responsible for feeding all the members of the household, for telling them what to do, for assigning to them their work. He had a position of great authority, responsible only to his master. Paul says here, leaders in the church do not belong to the church. They do not belong to the people. They belong to Christ. And that means that human judgments of their work are irrelevant. He says in verse 3, I care very little if I am judged by you or by any human court. He says, I am not employed by you, I am not responsible to you, and I care very little if I am judged by you. He goes on in the next verse. I do not even judge myself. My conscience is clear, but that does not make me innocent. I'm not guided, he says, by your opinion of my work. I'm not even guided by my own opinion of my work. I may feel that I'm doing very well, but that's irrelevant. I may be inclined to pat myself on the back and say, what a good boy am I, but that's irrelevant. Now let us just pause a moment to note and understand what Paul is saying and what he's not saying. He is not saying that he is indifferent to the opinion of the Christians among whom he works. Surely it would be a very foolish, a very arrogant man who would say that. He's not, as it were, as if I were to stand up tonight and say, I couldn't care less what any of you think of me, what any of you think of my sermons, or the way I do my work, a matter of complete indifference to me. Paul's not saying that. Definitely not. He's a sensitive man. He's a humble man. He has close relationships, communication with the people among whom he works. Nor is he saying that there is no place for honest self-examination. He's not saying that it's not right and proper for us to try to assess our own service of God and try to value it and say, is it worthwhile? Is it not? He's not saying that. What he's saying is, he's saying to his people, in the final analysis, you do not have the right to give the final verdict on my service of Christ. You have no right to draw up the bottom line, to pronounce the judgment on me. Nor am I the best judge of my own effectiveness, or of my own usefulness, or of my own value. Because, he says in verse 4, it is the Lord who judges me. It is the Lord who judges me. Paul says to the Corinthians, I won't answer to you. I will have to answer to Christ. He is my master. He is my employer. He is my king. And ultimately, what you may think of me doesn't matter. What I may think of myself doesn't matter. The great question is, what does Jesus Christ think of me? How does he assess my work? He alone has the right to pass judgment. You do not. And he goes on to make a very important and valuable point. Not only does the Lord have the right to pass judgment on his servants, but he alone has the ability. Because he says in verse 5, at the day of judgment, he will bring to light what is hidden in darkness and will expose the motives of men's hearts. And will expose the motives of men's hearts. That, friends, which we cannot see and cannot know. Some friend of yours walks past you on the street without speaking. Or perhaps they speak to you in a very curt, almost angry fashion. And you're offended. And you say, well, I met that person. I thought they were a friend of mine. And they cut me dead. They just ignored me. Well, they might have had a blinding headache. They might have been feeling extremely unwell. They might have heard some tragic news which has broken their hearts. They might have been daydreaming. It could be a multitude of things why they walk past you without speaking, and you or I don't know. And yet we're so quick to judge, aren't we? And Paul is saying, none of us knows what goes on in another person's heart. None of us knows their motives, their sincerity, their earnestness, their purity. You don't know how long your leaders pray for you. You don't know so many things about them. God alone knows these things. God alone is in a position to weigh this up. And so he says in verse 5, therefore judge nothing before the appointed time. Wait till the Lord comes. Judge nothing, he says. Now, of course, he's not forbidding them from all kinds of judgment, because we'll see in a couple of weeks in chapter 5 that he rebukes them severely for not judging in a case of discipline in the church. They weren't judging, and he says, you're wrong not to judge. How then does he say here, judge nothing? He's talking about sitting in judgment where we've no authority to do so, where we've no knowledge to do so, where we've no right to do so. Judging the servants of another master, as if they were our servants. They have no right to judge. My friends, this is a valuable reminder, not just about Christian leaders, but about fellow believers. Many of us are cursed with a critical spirit. We're just far too judgmental. We're far too ready to judge and criticize other believers. Paul says here, how much do you know about that person? How much do you really know? And what right do you have to judge that person? As he says in Romans, who are you to judge someone else's servant? To his own master, he stands or falls. They have no right to judge. But then secondly, in verses 6 to 13, he points out that they are in no position to judge. They are in no position to judge. And it's important at this point to remember why the Corinthians were criticizing Paul. They weren't criticizing him because of sin in his life. That's valid criticism. They weren't criticizing him because he was failing in his duties. That's proper criticism. They weren't criticizing him because he preached falsehood. They weren't criticizing him for poor sermons. Why then were they criticizing him? Why did they not like him anymore? He wasn't smooth enough for them. He wasn't polished enough. He wasn't a Greek orator. He wasn't handsome enough. He wasn't impressive enough. He didn't have an obviously attractive personality that would appeal to Corinthian society. They wanted their leaders to look exciting, to sound dynamic. They wanted leaders who were oozing with what people call personality. Isn't that what people look for today? They, of course, have a strange idea of what personality is. It usually means somebody with a great deal of impudence and cheek. But that's what they wanted. Somebody with personality. Somebody dynamic and splendid gifts. And Paul was just a little shabby, ordinary looking man. A man who had to even make his living from manual labor. And they were ashamed of him. They were ashamed of him. He didn't look like an apostle. He didn't sound like an apostle. He wasn't the sort of leader whom they wanted to follow. If they had brought their unconverted friends to church and Paul had been preaching, they would have felt ashamed and embarrassed of that funny little man standing up at the front. That's why they were criticizing. And in these verses, in a passage of biting irony, almost verging on sarcasm, Paul contrasts how they see themselves with how he sees himself. Look how he describes them. And remember, this is irony. Already, he says, you wonderful people, you've all you want. Already, you've become rich. Already, you have begun to reign. That's a better translation than the NIV translation. And that without us, you don't need us. You are so wise, aren't you, in Christ? You are so strong. You are honored. That's how they saw themselves. Strong, wise, honored, rich, and reigning. Everything they wanted. What an attractive picture. Who wouldn't want to be described like this? By contrast, he says, we apostles are on display at the end of the procession like men condemned to die in the arena. When a Roman general was having a triumph, he would start off with his officers and his leaders, and then his soldiers, and then the treasures they had won, and all the booty, and the slaves. And then at the end of the procession, there would be a group of little men in rags. Men who were going to be thrown to the lions. A disgraced, contemptible little group of slaves. Paul says, we're like that. We've been made a spectacle to the whole universe. We are fools. for Christ. We are weak. We are dishonored. To this very hour, we go hungry and thirsty. We are in rags. We are brutally treated. We are homeless. We work hard with our own hands. And at the end of it, he uses expressions which are truly shocking. He says, up to this moment, we have become the scum of the earth, the refuse of the world. That's who we are. Scum. Rubbish. That's an accurate description of the sufferings and the reputation of the apostles, the preachers of the gospel. Could any two groups be more different than the Corinthians and their leaders? Corinthians, they saw themselves as rich, wise, strong, and honored. Their leaders, the scum of the earth. Now what's Paul doing here? Why do you think he's writing like this? What's his argument? Why is he drawing attention to the contrast between these wonderful, happy, successful, prosperous, popular Corinthian Christians and this pathetic little group of despised men who are treated as rubbish? Why is he pointing out this contrast and almost exaggerating it? Is he not putting a weapon into the hands of his critics? Is he not giving them ammunition? So they say, well, Paul, to be frank, Paul, that is why we're not too happy about you being one of our leaders. Because who wants to be led by the scum of the earth? Now, what sort of a minister do you have in your church? Well, frankly, he's the scum of the earth. Is that how you would like to describe your pastor? What's Paul doing here? Remember his teaching so far in this epistle. We preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews, foolishness to Gentiles. God chose the foolish things, the weak things, the lowly things of this world, and the despised things. Paul is saying here, my dear Corinthian friends, Jesus was despised and rejected and crucified. Now I ask you, which of us is more like Jesus? You or I? God chose the weak and the foolish and the despised to love. Which of us is more like the people God chose? The gospel of salvation is utter foolishness to the world. Which group has a lifestyle which fits in better with that gospel? You in your wealth and security and comfort, or us in our rejection and poverty and suffering? You Corinthians boast about being rich and popular and successful and gifted, and you despise us because we are poor and suffering and disregarded. But which of us is the more authentic Christian? In the light of all that I've been teaching you, what does God think? You're not in a position to pass judgment on me. Instead of your empty boasting and your shallow criticism, you should be ashamed. You've presumed, he says, to set yourself up as judges of me and of the other apostles, but you're the ones who are not like Christ. You're the ones who are not living authentically Christian lives. You're the ones who don't fit in with the foolishness of the gospel, or with Christ crucified, or with God choosing the little contemptible nobodies. You're the ones who are out of line and out of touch with who God is and what God is doing in the world. Instead of criticizing me, you are under the judgment of God. And that is the purpose of the tremendous irony of this passage. You're so pleased with yourselves. But God doesn't love people who are pleased with themselves. You're so honored. But God picks dishonorable people. You're boasting about your strength. But God comes and works through those who are weak. You're proud of the wisdom of your message. But it's the foolishness of Christ crucified that God blesses. You're in no position, he says, to judge me. And then lastly, in verses 14 to 21, he makes his third point. They should imitate him, not criticize him. They should imitate him, not criticize him. Paul at this point moves to the positive. I think he's saying at the beginning of verse 14, I'm not writing this to keep you in a state of shame. He certainly does want to shame them. He wants to embarrass them, but not to keep them there. I want, he says, to warn you as my dear children. He says, my dear friends in Corinth, you've been criticizing me, but you're forgetting one thing. I'm your father. You've all sorts of teachers, 10,000 guardians in Christ, all sorts of people who are preaching to you, advising you. Who brought you to faith? I brought you to faith. I came and preached the gospel. And God blessed my preaching. And humanly speaking, you owe your Christian life to me. In Christ Jesus, I became your father through the gospel. So he says in verse 16, therefore, I urge you to imitate me. That's the thrust of this chapter. As children should imitate their parents, a boy is father, a girl is her mother. Imitate me, he says. In other words, live as I do. Suffer. Be weak. Be despised. Be the scum of the earth. That's what he's saying when he says, imitate me. Lay aside those things which you think are riches and honor. And be willing to become the scum of the earth, the refuse of the world. For this reason, he says, I'm sending you Timothy, and he will remind you of my way of life in Christ Jesus. In other words, he's saying here that instead of foolishly criticizing their spiritual father, they would be far better to concentrate on trying to follow his godly example. And he says at the end, there's the sound of the smack of parental discipline. I'll not take time to expound the verses, but he says that if some of you children of mine want to behave in a boastful, cheeky way, then I will have to treat you like naughty children, and I am well able to give you the spanking that you so richly deserve. And he says in verse 21, what do you prefer? Shall I come to you with a rod, or in love and with a gentle spirit? It's up to you. Instead of criticizing me, your father, he says, you should imitate me. You should live as I do. A few words of application as we bring our study to a close. I wrote down, our congregation is mercifully free of criticism of its leaders.
And then I reflected that, of course, if there was criticism, the leaders probably wouldn't know whether it's going on or not. So all I can say is that as far as I can see, our congregation is free of criticism of its leaders. No doubt there are grievances and complaints. Perhaps some of us do need to be less judgmental of our leaders and remember that they do have a difficult task. And certainly less judgmental of other believers. And each one of us knows our own heart and whether we're too critical or not. But surely, friends, leaving that aside, this remains a very uncomfortable passage. But isn't it true that in some ways we are much more like the Corinthians than like Paul? We're quite comfortable. We're quite secure. We've everything we need. We're fairly well regarded by our friends and by many who are outside the church. We're respected. We've a good name, just like the Corinthians. And we haven't any great urgent needs, just like the Corinthians. We don't feel deeply unhappy or brokenhearted, just like the Corinthians. And most of the time we think we cope pretty well, just like the Corinthians. And as you know, in some sectors of evangelicalism today, these things are recommended. And we're told that to be wealthy and healthy and happy is a sign of God's blessing. And that all Christians should be this all the time if they have enough faith. And when I read in this chapter of weakness, dishonor, hunger, persecution, and slander, I ask myself, how much do I know, really, of those things? How much do you know of those things? Yet Paul says, I urge you to imitate me. And perhaps we're pretty pleased with ourselves as Christians, with a long and honourable tradition. We have a good theology and perhaps think that we've a pretty good grasp of doctrine. And because we're orthodox in our doctrine, we value ourselves highly. And I couldn't help thinking of Christians in many other parts of the world who may be much, much closer to Paul and to his example than we are. They really are poor and hungry and slandered and persecuted and despised. Are we not a bit too comfortable? Are we not a bit too pleased with ourselves? A bit too self-satisfied and secure? What do we really know about cross-bearing? Paul speaks to these comfortable, complacent Christians, and he says, listen, you're missing the whole point. I urge you to imitate me, the scum of the earth. Well, you may say, well, what do you suggest? What are we to do about this? Should I go out tomorrow morning, empty my bank account, give away all my possessions, so that I'm poverty stricken, and then I would be like Paul? Should I knock on every door in my street and shout, you're going to hell? And then I would be really unpopular, and I would be like Paul. Is that what we're saying? Well, of course not. That would be foolishness. And as I thought and wrestled about this, how can we imitate Paul? How can we do what he tells us to do? Surely it brings us back to the beginning of the chapter. Men ought to regard us as servants of Christ